The thing I've learned most about myself doing this show is how bad I am at pronouncing names. I mean, what you don't hear is the people behind the scenes who have to do all the editing to get the pronunciation that's nearly the most correct out of the thousands I've had to do in retakes. But apart from that, Neha, probably just exploring these topics with you and actually getting to catch up with you, you know, every month and just chat with people and chat with some amazing guests. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
I think the thing that I've learned the most through the last two seasons of the Read Me podcast is actually about myself. I feel like I've become a lot more comfortable in my skin. I started out really uncertain. I've started to really enjoy my role on the podcast, not to do the explaining. It's to do the encouraging. It's to like shine a spotlight on someone else. And a lot of times I can relate to the listener. I am the listener, but I get that chance to hopefully ask the questions that other people are asking or add a personal perspective to it that's like very relatable. I think that that was the biggest gift that I got. This is the Read Me podcast, a show dedicated to the topics, trends, stories, and culture in and around the developer community on GitHub. I'm Neha Batra, and I lead GitHub's core productivity team.
And I'm Martin Woodward from the GitHub Developer Relations team.
Welp, first up, Martin, we've got a bit of news to share. After an awesome year, we are going to be taking an end-of-season hiatus.
Yeah, we are, yeah.
Obviously, it's been such a fulfilling year. We've learned about everything from gaming development to nuclear fusion, accessibility and open source, to the secrets of the world's top maintainers. And we've met some amazing people, which means that while we're away, you should definitely check out any episodes that you've missed.
But before you do that, we of course have a whole lot of brand new content coming at you right now in this episode.
Yep, we're going to speak with Ricardo Miron Torres on the Digital Public Goods Alliance, and senior editor Clint Finley is here to talk with us about PHP, Laravel, and what makes us a happy community.
And for Ask RMP, we turn the tables a little bit and answer a question ourselves. But first, it's First Commit.
On your mark, get set. We're riding on the internet.
Today, we'll start in 1991, in Great Britain, the University of Cambridge, to be specific. The place was crawling with scientists, droves of scientists working to make groundbreaking discoveries that would change the world. And those scientists needed a lot of energy and inspiration. What helps with that?
Well, for me, it's a nice cup of tea, but actually, I think this one involves coffee, doesn't it?
Yep, you got that right.
You see, the problem was all those scientists had to share a communal coffee pot. They'd be right in the middle of their experiments, maybe pulling an all-nighter, you know, and you're desperate, you need that shot of caffeine. So you walk all the way through the office, you get there, only to find the pot empty and slightly smelly. It's so disappointing.
Oh, come on!
Ah, that's the worst. I don't experience that as much anymore because I'm working from home, but I do have memories from people being in the office and the coffee running out, and it's devastating. I feel like when you're done, you have to tell people.
But, you know, give a bunch of nerds a problem that could be solved with human communication, where you could solve it with a computer, you know which option they're gonna take. They set up a camera to monitor the coffee pot, and it was this really low-res, like, early 1990s camera. They put it in the computer lab, connected it to the local network, and then they actually created a live feed that showed you just what was happening if the coffee pot was running on empty, and then it saved you having to run down the hall and take a look.
So, like so many groundbreaking technological innovations before it, necessity, and maybe a little caffeine withdrawal, was the mother of invention. This very first webcam was no different. It was invented because people didn't want to walk down the hall if there wasn't coffee waiting for them. And fun story, when I was in college, they actually had monitors for their laundry machine so that we didn't have to go all the way down to figure out whether the laundry machine was still occupied. Best invention ever, especially for a college dorm.
That's genius.
One of the goals Martin and I have had throughout this year is to really share with you all of the cool things that people are doing in the open source community around the world. And one of those things we wanted to explore today is the community that has grown up around digital public goods, which includes open source code, open data, open AI models, Wikipedia, and a lot more.
Yeah, our guest today is Ricardo Moron Torres, who's a technical coordinator and community manager for the Digital Public Goods Alliance. That's a UN initiative that was created to unlock the potential of open source to make a more equitable world. There are more than 30 international member organizations, including governments, as well as GitHub and other private companies.
We're going to hear more about the equity gaps that the Alliance is aiming to close. But first, we wanted to hear a bit more about how Ricardo got involved.
So my background is on software development, but I was pretty much involved on open source communities. And I started to get a little bit more of the interest in civic tech, which is mostly how we do technology to solve public problems. And I work in a lot of different things around human rights, around mobility, around transparency of government, stuff like that. So when the opportunity came to join the Alliance, it was like pretty much a straightforward for me, a place to be to kind of play a role in how the conversation of open source was relevant to solve some of these challenges. And of course, it's a good place where not only civic tech, but other things like digital identity, like GovTech, like a lot of the things we're hearing now with AI are also very relevant to this conversation. And I think this is what led me to the Alliance and kind of helping shape this global stage for open source.
Wow. I'm a tactical person, so now my interest is super piqued. And I'm really curious because you went over a few examples initially that you just covered with this wide breadth of themes that DPGA covers. But tactically, how does the Alliance determine what kinds of challenges to take on? And do you have any examples of initiatives or projects that you're excited about?
As you know, not all open source is made the same. And when we're trying to solve some of the world's hardest challenges like climate change, misinformation, disaster relief, and so on, these digital solutions need to take into consideration not only putting the source code out there, but also consider things like data privacy and security, the use of open standards for interoperability, the legal side of things as well, like having a proper license, copyright, adherence to laws and regulations, and all of these kind of things. And these solutions must be, I think, consciously designed to anticipate and prevent and do no harm by design. So this is what we think digital public goods should be. And actually, the Alliance has created a DPG standard, which is this set of criteria that help us define what characteristics should a DPG have. And as you mentioned, it's not only for software, but for data content, AI standards, and so on. Maybe the first project I would like to talk about is open source digital healthcare information system that was created by the University of Oslo, and it's called DHIS2. It's the backbone of digital healthcare in more than 100 countries and serves almost a third of the world's population. So even depending on where you are hearing this, or your government or you might be using this software. So I find very inspiring a story of one of these countries, which is Sri Lanka, a small country in the south of Asia, that leverage this open source platform, DHIS2, to create on top of it a COVID-19 tracker. And they were able to create and deploy this app in just a couple of days from which they detected their first case. This allowed them to do contact tracing for COVID cases, and they shared the source code of this app with the community just in a couple of months. And thanks to the fact that it was based on this already well-used digital healthcare platform, it was adopted by around another, I think, 32 countries and probably helped save thousands of lives. And this is something that wouldn't have been possible at this scale if everyone was working on silos, for example, or with their own proprietary solutions, stuff like that. This level of scale and adoption was, of course, not a coincidence. As I mentioned, it was not just because the code was open, but it was designed this way. It was well documented. It had the right license. It was interoperable with the system, and it was designed from the start to be a digital public good. And as important as this is that it had this global stage as a DPG with a strong community of maintainers, contributors, implementers, and more.
Yeah, what's fascinating to me is, you know, why all government isn't done this way, really, because the taxpayers, the citizens pay for the development of these things. And it almost seems strange that those should be proprietary. You know, it's also fascinating how countries you mentioned, like Estonia and India, you know, who are high tech you know, have high-tech populations are leading the way when it comes to some of these sorts of sharing and initiatives, because they don't have existing kind of proprietary infrastructure in place and, you know, maybe don't have all the state governments have the resources to be able to pay for proprietary products. So by being able to share them and in the open, you get to get those economies of scale as well. So no, it's brilliant. But with all this stuff that's happening, obviously here at GitHub, we've been trying to do a big push to make sure all this open source is available to everybody. And that includes people, you know, with disabilities. Is there any specific tools within the Digital Public Goods Alliance to help with accessibility of these public goods?
There are many things that we consider, and some of these are more like we could say best practices. And a lot of these best practices have to do, of course, with accessibility of the solutions in itself. We have a couple. For example, there's one created in Argentina that's made to assist with learning of children that have deaf disabilities. But there are several other examples I mentioned with children, but also with refugees, with elderly people, and so on, right? So this is definitely something that digital public goods take into consideration.
That's really great to hear. And obviously, you know, from the GitHub perspective, one of the things that my mind goes to is it's such a privilege to be able to give tools and opportunities to people openly and transparently. And what comes with that is the fact that there is some maintenance work and there's someone behind the scenes that has to keep things up. So I was curious, from your side, how do you ensure the long-term sustainability and maintenance with all of these digital public goods? And how do you measure the impact of them?
Yeah, so it's really hard to actually measure the impact of an open source project in general, mainly because by design is sometimes that way, that you never know who's using that solution. But of course, sustainability is one of the key focus of the Alliance. And part of what we do is we provide this support through our member organizations. We promote visibility of these resources, which in itself increases the likelihood of continued support, funding, contributions, and ensuring the viability and maintenance over time. It's also a great work that the projects themselves carry on, right? And sometimes in ways they never could figure it out. There's this really interesting project called RapidPro, which was developed, I think, even way back on 2005 or 6 or something like that, which was a start like a really small project with no real intention to kind of scale into what is right now. And it got some funding from UNICEF to mainly be used to give assistance for organizations to use SMS services for not connected areas to facilitate communication between clinics and community health workers for food distribution and stuff like that. But then it got used in so many other use cases that they probably have never imagined. For example, here in Mexico City, where I'm from, they use RapidPro to alert and give notifications to citizens when we have earthquakes, which happens quite a bit of often. And I even personally work on a project before joining the Alliance that used this open source tool to help guide families in Central America to report and search missing people and other human rights efforts. So as part of this, we got into contribute back to the project as well, fix some bugs and improve overall the open source project, which is in itself a digital public good. So it's a mix of the community actually using the project and contributing back, as well as actual formal funding and support from organizations like UNICEF, but there are many others that are helping us achieve these goals to promote digital public goods and keep sustainability of these projects.
One of the important things as well is while some of these systems are relied on in times of crisis, that's also the worst time to be building them.
Yeah.
So as the community manager, if people want to get involved now in time, you know, where things might be stable for them, how should they get involved with your communities?
So there are a couple of ways that you can join these different communities. One is directly through the open source projects that exist. And for this, we have the Digital Public Goods Registry, which provides like a single and easy accessible repository of all of these projects, and it has information surrounding like where it's being developed, where it's being deployed, the organizations that support the solution. So if there's anything that's of your specific interest, that's a way that you can directly identify and discover these kind of projects where you can contribute to. But we also have some more formal community building initiatives that we have worked on. For example, last year, we collaborated on Hacktoberfest to highlight some of these projects and for individual contributors to kind of participate in these activities. But as an organization, you can also partner with us, with the Alliance, or even join the Alliance. And since we're a member-based, there's a lot of strategy involved on how we host this community, how we push certain campaigns, for example, to highlight TPGs that are being deployed to address issues in particular sectors, or finally, by engaging specifically with countries who are adopting these TPGs and kind of taking part on that digital transformation journey. So it depends if you're looking more for a technical contribution, then the TPG registry, I think, is the great place. But otherwise, if you're an organization with some other kind of interest, then you can easily reach out to us and we can collaborate on many things.
It's also really good to hear that there are so many different ways to contribute, and it's not just the technical contributions. So I feel like that's a really good sign of a healthy open source project. Is there anything that you wish people knew, or like a common misconception?
On the digital public goods definition, there are like many views on what's a digital public good, and the work we do, and for example, the standard I talk about, is one of the ways that we help define through the organizations that are part of this alliance, create this common understanding of these kinds of projects. But this doesn't necessarily mean that only the projects on the DPG registry are the only digital public goods. We're always trying to search for new projects, new initiatives, especially those that are not necessarily software. This is like an ongoing conversation in itself. Like the DPG standard is an open project that anyone can contribute and help shape this definition, and also help even nominate or promote some of these solutions. So it's not like a super strict thing where everything's set in stone, but rather that it's an ongoing thing and something that's like really on the works with many topics like AI, also changing a little bit of the landscape of what we think of open source.
Yeah, I like that, like a living and breathing definition.
Yeah.
Ricardo Miron Torres, a technical coordinator and community manager for the Digital Public Goods Alliance, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and excited to see some contributions come along to these digital public goods.
And to learn more about DPGA, check out digitalpublicgoods.net.
So Neha, have you used PHP or Laravel at all?
Kind of. My first job, we were moving from Drupal off of Drupal and PHP onto a Java backend and moving things into middleware and backend and separating things out. So I had like a brief brush with it. What about you?
So remember, I'm old, and there was a time before like Hotmail existed and like Gmail and things. And I wanted to access my email from work, which was, you know, not allowed because like port SMTP, whatever, and IMAP ports you couldn't access. So obviously I built myself a web client for IMAP over, you know, using PHP at the time it was, that I just ran on my own little web server so I could access my email from work. That was my experience, and it was back before anything fancy like Drupal or Laravel actually existed. You know, it was like raw PHP. And I think there's this bias still that exists in a lot of a dev community around PHP from the old days of creating, yeah, you know, unreadable regexes and things. But also now, you know, especially with things like Laravel making things so easy, that actually I think there's some pushback against that, I guess. At least that's the sort of sense I'm seeing. But we're going to talk today about how simple could actually be better for many people, and just how happy and vibrant the Laravel community is.
And to do that, we'll be joined once again by the README Project senior editor, Clint Finley. Hey, Clint.
Hey, Neha. Hey, Martin.
Hey. So Neha and I chatted a bit about this already, but why do some people kind of think that Laravel is their secret weapon?
Yeah, well, I mean, like you said, it just makes things really simple for people. So I heard from Fathom Analytics CTO Jack Ellis that it just makes them really efficient. They can write code very, very quickly. He says it saves them hundreds, maybe even thousands of hours of development time. And the reason for that is, just so much is built into it already. He was so enthused about it that he rebuilt their product from Go into PHP, which, you know, just seems really counterintuitive. Like Neha was saying, they migrated from PHP to Java. And that's sort of the expected move, is that you would go from something like PHP, a dynamic language like that, over to a compiled language like Java or Go for the performance capabilities. But what Jack Ellis was explaining was that they didn't really need that infrastructure level performance. And if he did, that he would have stuck with Go, or he would build it with Go. But even for the hundreds of thousands of API calls that they process, PHP was still, you know, more than adequate for that. And they were able to work, again, just much more efficiently, much more quickly using PHP than something that was less familiar to him, like, you know, in this case, Go.
And I think, you know, familiarity for sure, and making sure that, you know, the language suits the basic needs that you have. Those are a few pieces of why someone would use it. But there must be something different about Laravel and like why someone would want to choose it over anything else. So what are the unique features about it?
The big thing that people bring up again and again is just how it's essentially a batteries included, you know, very opinionated framework. So there's not a whole lot of decisions that you have to make. A lot of things are already there for you. Authentication, obviously. So that's, you know, kind of the story for a lot of software, though. That's, you know, the exact same thing that people who like Ruby on Rails will tell you. Though, I guess with JavaScript, that's a lot more fragmented. So there's, you know, a big appeal for somebody maybe coming from the JavaScript world to see that, you know, you can have it kind of everything already done for you and not have to cobble things together. But even compared to Ruby, Laravel has a lot of, I guess, perks. Queues is something that a lot of developers told me they were excited that is just built right into Laravel, whereas you might have to pay for that as an add-on feature in another platform. Laravel does a lot to make deployment easy, which is kind of a tradition, I think, in PHP, is just the deployment story there is really appealing. Another aspect, Martin mentioned that there is a lot of prejudice against PHP that stems from the earlier days of it. And something that came up a lot is that PHP is just a lot better than people think it is, that it's evolved significantly over the last several years, over the last, I guess, decade. There was kind of a period where it stagnated in maybe the late aughts, early tens, but starting maybe around 2012, it really started to catch up and possibly even surpass other languages. So a lot of the things that we've talked about in this podcast before, type-sadey, pure functions, you know, for functional programming, those are things that PHP has now. And then just going back to Laravel, Aaron Francis, who has been on this podcast before as well, just talks about the developer experience as being really solid. There's great documentation. He says Taylor Otwell just really puts a lot of focus on things like just fixing what he describes as sort of paper cuts, like just the little things that annoy you, that he puts a lot of time and effort into fixing those sorts of things so that the developer experience is just really smooth. And then the other thing is just the community is just happy. That's what put me onto this story in the first place.
Yeah, I think, you know, if it hadn't been for Facebook, it felt like PHP would have died a long time ago. And then things like Drupal as well seem to be keeping them alive. But when Laravel came and started becoming a lot more popular, it definitely seemed to see a new resurgence. And the community around Laravel in particular is just phenomenal, isn't it? It's a massive community out there.
And again, just a community that isn't doing a lot of infighting all the time. And I noticed I would talk to people who would say, you know, I love Node, but I wish JavaScript had a standard library. Or I remember the big fights over callbacks in Node, I think, or generics in Go. You know, a lot of issues with packaging in Python that are starting to finally be resolved. But just all these little things that cause dissatisfaction or arguments and things like that. Whereas in Laravel, I mean, you know, it's not always an apples to apples comparison because it's a framework and not a language, but people were just really pleased with it and just really happy to be using what they're using and not interested necessarily in like jumping around and doing stack hopping, which, you know, something else I tend to see a lot. They're just really kind of in love with PHP. I spoke with Mohammed Saeed about this, and he's a former Laravel employee who's now the VP of infrastructure at the Dubai cloud-based restaurant software company Foodix.
Well, for starters, everyone in the core team is reachable. Like, you can reach out to anyone in the core team and ask them questions, like show your pain points, what things you are working on, and how you think the framework can do something specific in a better way. People are reachable. It's very easy to reach them and talk to them, and they are always helpful. They are always engaged with all the concerns that people have. And that makes the person feel safe. Like, as a developer, when you know that the maintainers of the framework or the tool you're using, you know that you can reach them anytime, it makes you feel comfortable using the tool. If you're stuck with something, like, it's very difficult for you to figure it out, you can reach to anyone in the community, either in the core team or in the community itself, and people are really helpful there. And that's something like I haven't seen in other communities. It's something that's special about the Laravel community.
I think what's really interesting about what Mohammed said was that the community is a very important key aspect to someone being comfortable with a language. And especially for a language that's as old as PHP, it's gotten the chance to learn a lot of the lessons through the different hype cycles as they've come and gone and really hone in on what it wants to be good at. And as someone who, over time, I have to make so many decisions on a day-to-day basis, having a language that really intimately understands which ones I want to have autonomy over and which ones it wants to take that away from me and just make it easy and make it happen. There's something really special to go back to those basics and see those old languages that have survived this long and how they've evolved and are serving our needs today.
Yeah. So, I mean, Clint, why do you think if people haven't looked at PHP in a while and if people haven't really played with Laravel, why does this matter to them? Why is this important?
If you already know PHP, then, you know, definitely give Laravel a look, especially if you haven't looked at PHP in a long time. You might be pleasantly surprised. But, I mean, even developers who are only aware of Laravel's strengths can benefit, maybe learn some lessons from how it works. Here's what Mohammed had to say about that.
The most important thing is that an open source contributor or an open source maintainer needs to think about building something for the people, not the code itself. So a lot of people like get stuck into thinking that I'm going to write the perfect open source tool, I'm going to write the perfect code and everything, but they forget about writing good documentation. They forget about showcasing how their tool works, what problems it does solve. So that's something that Laravel does differently. It focuses on the use cases first and puts a lot of effort into the documentation. And even though the code is really good and it's well organized and performance is important, but Taylor focuses more on writing code for the people more than for the machines. So I think that's something that other open source contributors can learn from.
I love that people-centric view. Clint, thanks so much. And before you go, can you let us know what's coming up on the README project?
Sure. This month, Anton Myro Rodchenko shares his story of learning to program as a developer with cerebral palsy and how he uses GitHub Copilot and other AI tools to accomplish more than he could before. Then we have a guide by Drupal contributor Mike Gifford on what you can learn from Drupal's accessibility journey. We also have Nick Palm's guide on using the open source self-hosted GitHub Actions runner created by Philips. And finally, as you noted at the top of the show, the README project is taking a little break. We're doing that in part because we're going to be developing some new content and formats and new ways to serve you as an audience. So tell us what you loved, what you'd like to see, what we could do differently. Just send us an email at thereadmeproject@github.com with your thoughts. But Martin, Neha, before I go, and while I still have the mic, I'm thinking this is my chance to do something I've been holding back on all season. Turn the tables and focus on the two of you for this month's Ask RMP. So I'd love to know what the coolest thing is that you experienced or your most memorable moment of the season.
Oh, without doubt, my favorite moment was talking with Professor Annaloo Waller. That episode was just amazing for me, just learning all about the work that she did and just the pride that she had in her student. It was just wonderful to see, you know, and probably seeing you melt down as well, Neha. That was a good one in a different episode.
Oh, yeah, that was going to be my one, the interview with Kelsey Hightower, yeah, where I absolutely just broke into shambles during his response to the question around like one of his most memorable moments speaking at a conference and hearing him talk about representation and the value of it. I don't think I've been the same since that episode. And exactly what I needed to hear. It was absolutely wonderful. Definitely most memorable moment was that, and then choking through the ending of that and trying to say thank you while being in tears.
Like any narcissist, I listened to the show. And so I was listening through to the show later and, you know, listened to that part of the episode. And I was blubbing in tears thinking about your reaction while out for a walk in the countryside. So there we go. Yeah.
That's it for this episode of the Read Me podcast. We're so glad you joined us this season. Thank you to Clint Finley, Mohamed Saeed, Ricardo Miron Torres, and all of our guests this season whose stories, expertise, and insights are what bring the Read Me podcast to life, and to you, our listeners. We look forward to bringing you more soon and hope you'll keep in touch. Send us an email at thereadmeproject@github.com and be sure to subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also learn more about what we do at GitHub by heading to github.com/readme.
The ReadMe podcast is a GitHub production. A huge thank you to our hosts, Martin Woodward and Neha Batra, for bringing this season to life with their experiences, perspectives, and humor. Thanks as well to our senior editors, Clint Finley and Mike Melanson, for their incredible stories and reporting. Additional thanks to our production team at Reasonable Volume, Mary Dew, Rachel Swaby, Elise Hugh, Persia Verlin, Mark Bush, and Scott Somerville. The producers of the ReadMe podcast are Rob Mapp, Melissa Beiser, and Virginia Bryant. Our staff includes Stephanie Moorhead, Kevin Sundstrom, and Grace Beatty. Theme music by Xander Singh. Please visit github.com/readme for more community-driven articles and stories. Join us again soon, and let's build from here.
I was like hoping in post-editing that they would make me sound a little bit more normal, but no, I...
Sadly, hasn't worked yet. There's no AI that makes us sound normal.
Not magic, Neha. Yeah.